Welcome back to Good Food. The first time we talked to Deepa Reddy, she took us on an exploration of the South Indian soup, rasam. This time, she's back to talk about another favorite food, the banana. In India, it's more than a tasty snack or a good source of potassium. It has a huge cultural importance, and you'll find a lot more banana biodiversity.
The banana here is, as you said, so ubiquitous and so culturally important. We use the whole plant in so many different ways at so many different moments that it's almost impossible to navigate life without the banana. And that's really what I mean when I say that we think with the fruit. It's vital to the way that life works around here. If there's a banana, I mean, things are complete. A meal is complete. We eat fruits. Of course, we eat the flowers too. We eat the banana stems. We use the leaves to wrap and steam food. We use them as disposable plates. So the bananas are ceremonial offerings. The whole plant is a wedding decoration. They can be babies' first foods. You're going to see the thicker fibers used as cords to tie bunches of greens or, you know, other vegetables in the markets. The thinner ones are used to make either fabrics or even at home, you know, people will pull the fibers to make lamp wicks. So it's a kind of wish-fulfilling plant. And it's said that if you have bananas as well as mangoes and jackfruit growing in your backyard, you will never grow hungry. And in fact, neither will your neighbors.
What do we know about the banana's origins? From what I understand, all current cultivars probably originated in what is now India. Do we know how and when this happened?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure about when exactly. Some people say that banana varieties may have been cultivated in ancient Papua New Guinea as well. But indeed, there are stories about the ancient sages of India who were relishing the bananas. And then this is when Alexander of Macedonia and his generals found them here and took them back to different parts of Europe. So the story of the banana's dispersal around the world really does start in India. Although the Arabs took it on from here elsewhere. And in fact, I think it's them who gave the fruit the name banana, which I think it derives from the Arabic word that means finger or fingertip. In India, of course, the native home of the banana is the hilly regions of the country and the areas which are more like a tropical rainforest. That is mostly in the northeastern states, the Western Ghats, and in the Andaman Islands. So yeah, Musa acuminata and Musa balbicinia were once upon a time progenitors of most present day cultivars, along with several of peripheral species.
So let's talk about banana diversity. I mean, here in the U.S., we famously have the Cavendish banana and very rarely see other varieties except in markets that service small communities from different places in the world. What about in India, where you live? Tell us about your access to varieties of bananas.
Yeah, I mean, much broader. Most of us have grown up with several different varieties of bananas. In spite of living in India, some of them are so unique to a particular region that we've never visited or we've just heard of them. So there are bananas which are, even though they are grown in the subcontinent, are even legendary to someone like me, right? So each region, each state, each community in each state has its own micro cuisine. And all of these things are very, very tied to seasonal, locally available ingredients. And the banana can be very critical to those. Some of them can be what they call ecotypes, which means that even if you took a plant from one region and you grew it in another region, they'd just not be quite the same. They're quite variable like that. We don't tend to think of the banana as a juicy fruit, but you realize with some varieties that they can be that way. And then there are some like what we call the Hills banana, or it's known as the Virupakshi fruit, which are very firm and sweet and creamy, but with a kind of dry feel to them. They've got a good keeping quality. Then there's the Payan banana, which has some pretty distinct dense seeds in them, which you kind of just chew up as part of the banana. That one is actually a kind of after-dinner favorite in southern Tamil Nadu. And then there's an Assamese banana called the Bheemkol, which is one of those varieties which, because I live in the other end of the country, I've never actually tasted. I've only heard of this fruit. Then there are tiny bananas which are known as yelaki. Some of them can be no larger than, you know, the thumb on your hand, but they've got a lovely flavor and a nice bite. There's the rastali. It's known for its kind of juicy sweetness. There are some, for example, the kalvare, or what we call the stone banana, which is pretty much hard flesh and all seeds. So, I mean, this gives you a sense of the vast range of the different banana types around here.
We've been hearing for a long time about the banana apocalypse and how monoculturing bananas is a threat to their existence, specifically Panama disease caused by a fungus known as Fusarium wilt may bring about the end of the Cavendish banana. I mean, we've covered this story several times over the past 20 years. Mm. What is the latest on that?
I don't know that I have the sort of scientific latest on that. What I do know is that, well, I mean, wilt is around, and new variants like the tropical race 4, what's called the TR4, are still confounding folks. I think depending on whom you ask, you could feel at the edge of a precipice, or you could feel like, hey, this is no problem, we're going to get through this. But I think a lot depends on the treatment paths. Now, I'm not a farmer, I'm not an expert in banana diseases, but I think if you look around at how banana ailments have been treated, you're going to see a couple of stock approaches, right? One, of course, is just to douse it with chemicals approach, which we're increasingly finding to be not only insufficient, but also very, very problematic. The second is fine-tuned genetic engineering, which I think is also a lot in the news. And I think many people will pin their hopes, their best hopes on this. The third approach is another lab-based approach, which I understand has been used a fair bit in India. I mean, it's tissue culturing, using specific cells to regenerate whole healthy plants. And this was a method that was actually used to save what we call here the Hills banana from banana bunchy top disease. And then the last approach, which I find the most interesting, there are these bioformulations of the sorts that, you know, old Indian farmers would have used to enhance, like, say, a mango crop, using maybe manure, cow urine, neem, several other ingredients to create this body of antagonistic and growth-promoting microbes, which then get applied in the banana mats as a sort of vaccine for the plant. So the logic there being you take this and your immunity improves. So the reason that last one interests me the most is because it's usually very tactile, field experience based, drawing on just different kinds of knowledge and insight from different people. And this method of manufacturing a vaccine appears to confound the typical scientific approaches. So it appears to want to meet life with life, right? So we're not talking about irradiation. We're not talking about chemicals. We're talking about a microbial army that is sent out in defense of the banana. It doesn't really promise miracles, but it's more about reducing susceptibility. And it's an approach that seems to understand the problem of banana diseases and viruses and so on as being both very complex as well as ecosystemic.
We've heard so much about the story of the American United Food Company and Chiquita's influence on bananas, the colonial story, which needs to be told and not forgotten. But what do we miss if we focus too much on that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think we miss several things. We miss the fact that there is banana biodiversity in the first place. Now, I say that and I realize that's pretty ironic because the whole United Foods Chiquita story is about the monocultures, right? But focusing on monocultures doesn't necessarily educate us on what else is out there. It just tells us what went wrong, particularly from a labor and ecology standpoint. Then, of course, we miss the fact that there is a lot more affecting the world of bananas beyond Fusarium wilt, right? I mean, I mentioned earlier the banana bunchy top disease, for example, which is a threat enough in different African countries to have prompted the creation of the Alliance for Banana Bunchy Top Disease Control. The protection and care of the banana is a much bigger thing than just wilt. But I think perhaps the most important bit is that we miss the value that is accorded to the banana in different parts of the world. The United Fruit story is not really telling us about what is cherished and loved about the banana. The banana is a source of cultural sustenance as well, right? Not just physical. And the way it stands in for notions of family and social health, the way people love to talk about the banana, the way the plant becomes an extension of both the individual human being as well as the social body. I mean, these are the sort of nuanced textural cultural details that need to be more part of the big banana stories out there.
Deepa, it is always such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for coming.
It's been a pleasure again. Thank you again, Evan.
That was anthropologist and food writer Deepa Reddy, unpeeling the sociocultural layers of the banana. She's based in Pondicherry, India, and you can see more of her work at paticherry.com. That's spelled P-A-T-I-C-H-E-R-I.com.